The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the challenges for people transitioning from one gender to the next, learning a new voice, whether transitioning from biological male or female, innate vocal register may no longer match a person's new gender identity. A number of vocal coaches are now working with clients who are self-conscious about their speaking voices. The Butterfly Music Transgender Course is teaching them to sing.
So when someone comes into this group, they can sit in any section they want and they can change at any time. And we don't use soprano, alto, tenor, bass because it doesn't apply.
Sandy is really helping us be able to relearn how to use our voices.
Sandy, being mentioned in that video, is Sandy Hammond. She's the founder and artistic director of the Butterfly Transgender Music Chorus, one of the country's first choirs reserved for transgender singers. Sandy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Lori Wolf, a member and volunteer who works as a community liaison for the chorus. Hello, Lori.
Hi, Virginia.
Well, so
it's
glad
a pleasure to be here.
Well, glad to have you both with us. And, you know, I read about a number of transgender people who have a lot of anxiety about their voices. They don't want to leave messages, nervous about meeting people for the first time. Is that common to your choir members?
It is true for a number of our members. They may have had experience singing. They figure that that's no longer available to them. And in fact, some come saying that it's not easy being out in the world because as soon as they open their mouth, then people look at them very differently. And so the ease and the comfort that they experience can disappear. And so for some, they actually stop to open their mouths, and they start to become self-conscious.
Is that, in your experience, Lori, a sort of disconnect between your voice and how you looked?
The truth of that is that I think that to some extent there has been, but it was very internalized for me because I've been very active in the community. I do writing and performing, and I share stories from my life, stories and poems. And I also do speaking gigs. I go out and speak to classrooms and universities and colleges and high schools and even middle schools and churches and businesses. And I tell what it's been like so that it might be easier for those people that follow me.
Did you imagine how the voice you wanted to have would sound?
You know, I didn't even think about that until I met Sandy and got involved with the Butterfly Music Trans Chorus and had the experience of hearing what my voice would have sounded like had I been born in the gender that I am. So that was, it's amazing to me. And sometimes we'll play and I'll go back to the higher register, which is really lovely, but I'm still not used to it because I'm out there and do so much speaking. And to me, it's the message more than the tone. For others who might be younger, it's just really a lot more difficult for them.
Virginia, I think where I feel a lot of empathy for the singers I've met, I'm thinking of one student who, for her, passing as female is important. I think it's also important to say not everyone wants to pass, not everyone sees it as binary. But for her, going out as very feminine, and she's gorgeous and she dresses beautifully, for her, passing as female is really important. And her speaking voice is a barrier. And sometimes people don't want to go on job interviews. They don't want to speak up in a social setting. So you can imagine what that does to someone over time if they're scared to use their voice. It's literally a metaphorically silencing.
I can really imagine that. And I wonder if the chorus members who come to you, have they got experience singing, or is this just a way of finding that voice?
Both. Some singers come to the chorus. A common theme I hear is, I used to sing. And then I transitioned and I stopped. Hmm. And for me, that's just wrong. Everyone has the right to sing. And if you've identified as a singer your whole life, that's a huge loss. You know, and many trans people, when they transition, have losses left and right. Their family may kick them out of the house. They may lose a job, or they may be scared to re-enter the workplace in their new identity. They may lose a marriage or child custody, or, you know, depending on when they transition. It becomes another loss. And for someone who's always been a singer, and for whom perhaps music was a source of solace and joy, that loss can be devastating. So many of the singers that come to me are recovering their singing, and it's a profound joy. We do have some singers who've never sung before, and that's awesome too. They come in as beginners, and it's exciting. And I do think at some subtle level, even for people who are beginners, I hope that it helps with their speaking voice and their overall gender identity.
So how do you approach it? How do you teach people to alter the register of their voice?
It's very difficult. I will say that for trans men who take testosterone, it's a lot easier because they get this nice, deep drop in pitch. And pitch is one of maybe 9 or 10 variables you want to think about in speech. But, for example, if I talk here, it's really quite different than how I normally talk.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as someone in radio, you can modify your voice, but it takes practice. And I think what I see is many of my students are already dealing with social anxiety or depression, and the persistence it takes to practice week in, week out over time and modify speech is a challenge. They get discouraged early in the process. And what I want any trans person listening to this to know is it is worth working. Don't give up on your voice. For trans women, it is definitely more challenging. You can't turn a cello into a violin. The vocal cords for trans women, if she's transitioned later in life after the first puberty, the vocal cords are already large, masculine, thicker, deeper, more resonant. And modifying for a higher pitched, more feminine sound takes a lot of work. Someone with a background in linguistics or theater is going to or singing is going to have a much faster learning curve. But for some people, it takes 2 years. And that's a lot of work. That can be very frustrating.
I know that you have a really impressive resume, by the way. You had a Ford Foundation Fellowship in choral conducting, sang with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, you know, jazz and classical soloist, picked up by Columbia Records. So for you, what was behind your decision to start the choir for other people?
So I think a couple of things. As a performer, I love to perform, but there was something missing. I wanted my music to serve a higher purpose. And I don't mean that in any religious kind of way, but just a broader, more profound purpose. And sometimes performing feels empty to me. I come off stage, I feel like I'm not really sure what I contributed tonight. It may sound sort of strange, but it wasn't enough. And as a voice teacher, I want to help all of my students. And I had a few trans students, and I realized this is an unmet need. It's an unexplored territory in human development in terms of vocal anatomy, especially for trans men. It's an instrument that science and music teachers have yet to explore. So I was very moved by these students' individual stories. And, you know, I want to be a resource to every student. And for my trans students, I realized that there's no literature. I remember one day I sat in a coffee shop for 6-7 hours with a speech and language pathology student, a friend. We searched one academic database after another correlating transgender singing, transgender voice. There's a black hole, and we need to fill it. We need to do research. We need to provide services. We need to attract funding.
How many people are in the chorus?
We have about 25 active enrolled members for our spring season. We have another 25 singers on our mailing list who come to—we have a class that runs just before chorus. That's a drop-in setting, so we have another 25 singers on the list for that. It's a slightly different class.
Among the considerations for people who are transitioning from one gender to the next is the human voice. Does the old, innate vocal register still match a person's new gender identity? Well, we're speaking with Sandy Hammond and Lori Wolf, both of the Butterfly Music Transgender Course, which is helping people to establish a new voice for themselves. Is it likely that people's voices will change more than once as they go through the process, you know, take different hormones, retract from different hormones?
Well, for trans men, it's a whole process. So as Sandy was explaining, we really don't have any scientific research into the way that a voice will change through a second puberty. And that's, in effect, what's happening with trans men. With trans women, there is no ability to alter what's been changed. Mm. The female model is gone with the deepening and the enlarging of the neck and the vocal cord changes. So for women, again, that's something that they have to do. Or for those more trans female identified that might want to have that kind of a voice, that is something that needs to happen in work. And for the men, many of the men will decide not to take testosterone because mm-hmm. they enjoy singing and they love using their voice to hit the high notes and that beautiful mm-hmm. quality that's still there. For those that do want to do it, there's real trepidation because there is the fact that they will lose that register. And then to integrate it in their neurology so that they can hear themselves and be comfortable with it. And when they hear themselves, know that it's a note that they are good singing. That takes time. Sometimes that's the toughest part of that. So I would say there's nothing instant about transition, and with voices, the same thing applies.
I think, Virginia, that's a really interesting question because I've become more aware of how every voice is fluid over a lifetime. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I hear jokes about the only women you ever meet singing tenor are postmenopausal, ha, 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 you know, the vocal cords dry out and thicken. I mean, that's kind of a stereotype, but I've become aware. You know, I come across as a woman in my mid-40s, and if I were to modulate my voice, would I sound like I'm in my 20s, or could I sound older, and how would I manifest that? So for me, it's made me aware of how the voice identity is fluid over time, how all of us, to some extent, have a gender-fluid identity. Gender is not a fixed point. How do you say that someone is 100% female or 100% male? What does that mean? So it's made me much more aware of what is a feminine sound? What does that even mean? And why is it essential to my identity? And is it essential? But I think the voice can be fluid over a lifetime. And I'll just share, one student had a really heartbreaking story for me. What they said to me is, I was born with an intersex condition. My parents decided to pursue testosterone. Mm-hmm. And when I was 18, I emancipated myself and said, no, I'm female, and I'm now on estrogen. Well, what a journey that person has been on. No wonder they have to sort out their voice.
It's a border that I never even considered in this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
So you are organizing the course around this. You know, it's not a traditional
yes.
course. You don't divide between soprano, alto, tenor, bass. How do you organize then? How do you put the voices together?
Sure. So when you start a new paradigm, create a new paradigm, find a new paradigm, it's messy in the beginning. We were wandering in the desert for a while, experimenting every week together. I think what was important for me was that the door was wide open. I was determined not to impose a vocal or choral agenda. So that made for some pretty interesting rehearsals. Sometimes we did not approach it traditionally. A chorus member would come up front and write a song with the group and then lead it. We would, I remember one night, it was really a moment. I said, everyone, come around the piano. And we looked at the piano. And I pointed on the keyboard to where the range would typically be for, say, the lowest note of a bass or the highest note of a soprano. And I said, here's where we are right now. And it was really exciting to see the looks on people's faces, realizing we are figuring out something new. And I wanted the group to feel empowered to say, this is my range. I don't have a name for it yet, but it's not SATB. It's not this other thing that does not work for me and that is highly gendered. So it was definitely messy in the beginning, but we now have trans upper, trans middle, trans lower. People can jump octaves at any time. So if we're singing a line that goes down, for example, and the line starts to go below where they're comfortable, they just jump up and sing it an octave up. There are choral directors, I'm sure, who would, this would drive them crazy because you forfeit a certain amount of musical control. And for me, that's by design. It's not about me and getting a particular sound as a director. And not that we don't have artistic goals, but the process of vocal exploration and discovery and empowerment trumps everything.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of people want to hear the chorus after listening to this. And I did look around a couple of different places and couldn't find much. There were a couple of short videos. So is there a reason why we can't find recordings online of the chorus?
We haven't done much recording because people's privacy, sense of safety comes first. So rather than putting pressure on members to produce some kind of outcome, which ultimately is important, we guarded this first year very carefully to say, this is about you, your process, having a safe space to claim your voice and not producing some kind of result for the public.
Well, congratulations. I wish you the best on that. And thank you, Sandy Hammond, founder and artistic director. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lori Wolf, member of the chorus and a volunteer, thank you also.
You're welcome.
And you can find more on the Butterfly Music Transgender Chorus, including a couple of short videos and information on their upcoming concert in April. It's going to be at the First Church in Boston. All that at wordofmouthradio.org. Steve Banko spent 16 months in combat in Vietnam, and he struggled with post-combat depression ever since, causing him to occasionally question the value of his own life. But in his essay for This I Believe, Banko describes how a childhood belief was reaffirmed for him during some of the darkest times in his life.
I've been moved by the magic of Christmas music since the nuns in grammar school etched the words of the carols into my brain. That magic persists despite the memory of our prepubescent male voices that sounded more like a pond of bullfrogs than the Vienna Boys Choir. The music rose above us. Even our childhood rivalries and petty differences were no match for the spell of that music. I believe that Christmas music can touch the spirit. Those nuns taught me the music and the lyrics, but I would learn of the real magic about 10 years later. On Christmas Eve 1968, I was a patient in a military hospital in Yokota, Japan. My leg had been shattered by a couple of machine gun bullets in a 5-hour battle in Vietnam. My body was full of shrapnel and my hands had been badly burned. For 3 weeks, Army doctors in Vietnam struggled to save my leg. They sent me to Japan on that Christmas Eve to give a new team of surgeons a chance to work their magic. And I was in desperate need of magic. Somewhere, it was Christmas, but it didn't feel like it to me. At least not until I heard the music pipe through the PA system.
Silent night, holy night.
A chorus sang of peace on earth and mercy mild, and promised God and sinners reconciled. Another voice called to let us all with one accord sing praises to our heavenly Lord, and another to sleep in heavenly peace. But heaven and peace seemed so distant to me. My misery was interrupted by a low moan coming from the next bed. All I could see was a white cast shaped like a body. Cutouts for his eyes, nose, and mouth were the only breaks in the cast. Even as the music inched me toward comfort, the reality of pain anchored me in the present. But looking at my neighbor, enclosed in God knows what kind of pain, mine didn't seem nearly as important. The soft strains of Silent Night were filling the air of the ward when the nurses made the final rounds with our medications. When my nurse approached, I asked her to push my bed closer to the man in the cast. I reached out and took my new friend's hand as the carol told us, "All is calm, all is bright." We spoke no words to each other, none were needed. The carol revived the message of hope and the triumph of love for me. I felt a slight tightening on my hand, and for the first time that Christmas, I felt I would survive my ordeal. And for the first time in a long time, I wanted to. I believe there is magic in Christmas and the music that celebrates it, because it brings us closer together and closer to our own hearts.
Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For all its cheer, December brings with it a number of potentially awkward or befuddling situations. There are the holiday work parties with coworkers who lose the ability to judge personal space, gatherings with relatives whose vision of the world is drastically different than our own, and what to do when somebody re-gifts you the gift you re-gifted to them last year. Even if you figured out how to survive the holidays with aplomb, it is comforting to hear about other people's quandaries and see our professional advice columnist will weigh in. Mallory Ortberg is co-founder of The Toast and the fourth writer to take on the Dear Prudence advice column at Slate. She joins us now to share some advice for navigating the holidays. Mallory, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, so before the advice, congratulations on the new job. How do you prepare for a role like this?
Thank you. I prepared by rewatching that great TV movie about Ann Landers and Dear Abby starring Wendy Malick.
That's all you needed?
Which is one of the greatest movies of all time. I saw it at a very formative age, and it sparked a lifelong love of Wendy Malick. And I guess I've just channeled her ever since.
Well, you started your job in November, which I would think is a pretty busy month for advice givers.
I really wish I could have started in July when everyone's just worried about, can I leave work early on Fridays? But no, I got thrown in the middle of Thanksgiving and Christmas.
So what kind of things are you do you notice you're being asked frequently?
Well, I think, you know, it's a time of year when a lot of us spend time with people we would maybe not normally surround ourselves with. So it's kind of the one time of year when for a lot of people there's this question of, I'm angry about this, I'm frustrated about this, all these things are coming up for me about past slights and insults that I'm angry about. Is my obligation here to make peace or to advocate for myself and speak up on behalf of somebody who's being mistreated? How far should I bend over to accommodate somebody else versus is it reasonable of me to expect accommodations from other people? So it's a real doozy of a season. Everybody's getting cheek by jowl, jostling each other, getting upset. It's tricky.
Well, just to start taking that on, what do you advise? Is it time to let bygones be bygones and do things the way that you used to, or maybe establish some new patterns?
I just tell everyone to take to the sea. Just live a lonely life on your own coracle. You know, fighting against the waves, speaking to no one, seeing no one, with only the seagulls and your own thoughts for company.
That's great advice. I wonder if I could afford it.
Well, yeah, it's very specific advice. I think it depends a lot on a case-by-case basis. There are some people who have families who are deeply damaging, and it would be best to avoid them. There are some families where it's important to kind of swallow your pride a little bit and make nice. And there's some families where it's really appropriate for you to ask for something specific. And kind of depends on how open your own family is to hearing things like criticism or new ideas.
What do you think is the craziest question that you've fielded thus far?
Boy, you know, I think the one that still has stuck with me the most is the woman who someone at her office has been going through her email archives, printing out embarrassing emails she sent years ago and leaving them on her desk anonymously, just to let her know, I have access to your email. I think you said something you shouldn't have years ago, and I'm just letting you know that I know. And she doesn't know who it is. She doesn't know what they want. It's just this ghost of social anxiety.
Wow, that's pretty arch. What did you tell her to do?
I think I actually crowdsourced some of the answers on that one because I was curious about, you know, depending on who the person is, it may be, you know, illegal what they're doing. And there were some people who were suggesting it could be someone from IT who has access, or it could be someone she sent the emails to who's just printing them out. I think the conclusion we came to was that she would unfortunately have to talk to her boss about it, because she was just panicked that someone would find out. And it's the sort of thing where the cat's going to get out of the bag with this eventually. Anyone who's willing to print out your old emails is eventually probably willing to blow up your career. And honesty is the only way out of this.
Right now, you know, we have a lot of big and potentially contentious subjects going on in the news, which can be tough to navigate with the family, uh-huh. especially when uh-huh. you don't see eye to eye. So what do you do when you're with people who do not do the polite thing of avoiding religion or politics?
Oh, man. See, my thoughts on that are, if it is somebody you see once or twice a year, it is probably not the best use of your time to spend it arguing with them about something that neither of you are likely to change each other's minds about. And I think in that instance, if someone's just insistent on bringing up something really unpleasant, really contentious, at some point you just got to say, you know what, I love getting to see you once a year. I don't want to fight about this. I'd love to hear about how, you know, your garden is going or what's new at work. Just kind of refusing to take the bait. Hopefully not too many of your listeners are related to people who just love fighting. And they will eventually want to say something more along the lines of, it's so great to see you all again. Doesn't grandma look wonderful? Isn't the casserole fantastic? Or whatever it is that you're eating. Refuse to take the bait.
I saw a recent column that asked whether it would be appropriate to donate money to Planned Parenthood on behalf of relatives who do not support the organization. What was your advice?
It was not just that, it was in lieu of presents. What if I did this instead of giving them presents?
Well, that's a bit indignant, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I can certainly understand feeling really strongly. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Planned Parenthood is very much under siege right now. And that is, in my opinion, a very bad thing. But I also think, you know, that's a pretty aggressive move. And I would not love it if somebody sent to me an unsolicited donation to a charity that I objected to in my name. And so I said, because the conceit was sort of, I want to really let them know I'm not backing down from my views. And I said, you know, from the sound of your letter, I think they're very clear on what your views are. I don't think that they're mistaken about them. I don't think that you've given off the wrong impression. I think they know how you feel. And that it would cause an unnecessary fight if you did that. I advise you not to do that. So we'll see. Maybe she will. Maybe she won't.
Have some questions about how to gracefully survive the holidays? Well, Mallory Ortberg is with us, who is now also known as Dear Prudence. She's the fourth writer to take over the Dear Prudence advice column at Slate. And we have some holiday-specific quandaries for her today. Let's get away from the family for a moment and go to the workplace holiday party, which seems to be an area that you could use some advice. So what is the appropriate response when Arthur from accounting goes in for the hug?
Oh, man. I mean, I got to say, work parties, 3-drink maximum, just for everyone's sake. Like, go out with your friends afterwards if you want to keep having a party. But it's such a recipe for danger that every year offices will throw all their employees together with sometimes near unlimited booze and a year's worth of small resentments and weird relationships, and then just let everybody have at it. If someone tries to hug you and you don't want to hug, that's totally okay. Step back and say, actually, I don't hug. That is a fine thing to say. I think it is totally appropriate to be a non-hugger, and you do not have to go through life being hugged against your will just because other people like to do it.
Any particular white elephant gifts that should definitely be avoided, something that shouldn't go in the mix?
Oh, my gosh. I feel like you're asking me all these worst-case scenarios, and I'm really hoping, like, I hope the majority of your listeners have nice families and have pleasant coworkers and enjoy their holiday office parties. I hope that they're really nice.
We look for the disaster response here in New England. Always prepared.
Yeah, I mean, don't bring guys. Use your common sense. You know, don't give away something horrific. Don't give away a haunted doll with your name scratched into the arms. You know, that's just common sense. That's for family only. I mean, buy something that you could find at a department store. Something that smells nice. A gift certificate. You know this.
So what if somebody cheerily drops off a gift for you and you do not have one in return? Do you say anything?
Oh, that has happened to me because I am not a huge gift giver. I mean, I'll give gifts within my family, but I'm not a huge gift giver. And occasionally someone will get me one. And I think just, thank you so much. I really appreciate this. Happy holidays. It's fine. You can't always predict who's going to get you a gift. And, you know, supposedly the point of gift giving is to give someone a gift, not to set up a mutual exchange. We're not ancient Assyrian kings. They would have to, the gifts were really more about trade. That's not the point. The point is, we are not ancient Assyrians. If someone gives you a gift and you didn't get them one, thank them profusely and enjoy your present.
So, Mallory, does being an advice columnist now change how you approach your own issues?
Oh, yeah. I'm very centered now. I've stopped making mistakes. It's very exciting. I've grown half an inch just out of peacefulness and wisdom. And I have never had to apologize to anyone for hurting their feelings. That part of my life is now over.
That's miraculous. That's a great gig. Well, now that you are officially an advice columnist, where do you go or who do you go to when you need advice?
Oh, you know, I think the same way a lot of us do, which is we sort of, check in with a couple different friends, maybe one or two family members, maybe one or two people we know through work, and sort of try to crowdsource opinions. So I have a couple of good friends, my business partner, Nicole, my sister, who I think has really good judgment, a couple of exes, actually. I have some great exes, and many of them are very wise in the ways of the world. So I have a little team that I'll sometimes go to and send out a mass text or call them all in turn and say, what would you do?
Well, Mallory, thank you so much for bringing us through and congratulations again on the new gig.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And just remember, if it gets too messed up, take to the sea.
Mallory Ortberg, she answers questions for the Dear Prudence column at Slate. And you'll find a link to read her column at wordofmouthradio.org. Let's face it, Christmas songs can be pretty schlocky. And in Britain, a slew of new songs is released each year in a desperate stab to reach the top of the December charts. Here's the actor Bill Nye dishing out the ugly truth in the movie Love Actually.
But wouldn't it be great if number one this Christmas wasn't some smug teenager, but an old ex-heroin addict searching for a comeback at any price? So if you believe in Father Christmas, children, like your Uncle Billy does, buy my festering turd of a record, and particularly enjoy the incredible crassness of the moment when we try to squeeze an extra syllable into the fourth line.
I think you're referring to If You Really Love Christmas.
Come on and let it snow. Ouch.
And it's not just holiday theme songs that reach the top in the UK. Take 2000's winning song, Can We Fix It? By Bob the Builder. Sophie Gilbert is culture editor at The Atlantic and a Brit who suffered through a series of Christmas number ones. We asked her to explain this tacky tradition.
So the Christmas number one is something that British people have obsessed over, I think, for more than 40 years now. For some reason, every year around this time of year, people get really, really interested and fixated on what song will be number one at the week leading up to Christmas. And I think the first official song that was actually number one at Christmas time was Slade's Merry Christmas, Everybody, in 1973.
So here it is, Merry Christmas, everybody's having fun. Look to the future now, it's only just begun.
And then ever since then, we've had a sort of variety of different songs, some good, some bad, some really bad. And it's kind of been up and down since then.
You mentioned in your article about this a memory of a particularly bad Christmas number one from your childhood back in 1993. What was that one?
So in 1993, I was 10 years old, and the winning Christmas number one single was done by not really a children's character, but a sort of novelty character called Mr. Blobby. And he was a 7-foot pink and yellow, I guess a blob. He kind of looked like a bowling pin. He was nonverbal. The only word I think he could really say was blobby, which you'd think would be challenging when you're releasing a single, but apparently not in this case. And he released what gets my vote for possibly the worst Christmas single of all time, a song called Mr. Blobby.
The lyrics?
The lyrics are actually recorded, I think, by a children's choir, and then there are some other singers in there who sing about Mr. Blobby and about why he's, you know, actually a really good star and secretly a hidden talent, and everyone just misses it because he's, you know, known to be an idiot, and the only word he can say is Blobby.
Blobby, Mr. Blobby,
Okay, I listen to this and think number one song?
I think 600,000 people paid money for it in 1993.
Well, this kind of undoes every American idea about Brits having superior taste.
Yes, and I think really the one thing that the Christmas number one does is reveal that that is actually a myth, that we have very strange, very eccentric tastes sometimes, particularly at Christmas time when there seems to be this great affection for kind of novelty performers like Mr. Blobby and then in 2000, Bob the Builder.
So what's the deal? Why are Christmas number one so wretched?
It's a very good question. I mean, it's sort of become this thing now where originally I think it was a prestigious thing for a band to get at the Christmas number one, and over the past 10 to 15 years, actually, it's been taken over by The X Factor, which is a British reality show. I think most of the winners during that period have come from that. But there is also this sort of sense now that the Christmas number one needs to be subverted, either by strange acts or by, I think in 2009, there was a social media campaign to have Rage Against the Machine, you know, take the top spot, mm-hmm. which they did. Willing in the name of...
Well, I don't want to sound Scroogey about this. I mean, is there any joy at all in anticipating these new Christmas songs?
I think it's fun. I think it's become a part of the holiday tradition. And I think, like I said, we're a kind of eccentric nation and people sort of take joy every year in anticipating the new and strange and, you know, tacky and potentially very odd hits that we might get to listen to.
So it could be that it's so bad that it's good.
Exactly, which again is another very British tradition.
Have you ever liked the Christmas number one, Sophie?
There have been a few that have been actually quite good songs. But I think it's funny, some of the more prestigious and longer lasting Christmas songs seem to have got to the number two spot. I think you had songs like in 1994, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, which is obviously a huge Christmas hit, only managed to get to number two. I think in 1984, Wham's Last Christmas only got to number two. So it seems like, oh, and then in 1987, The Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York, which is a wonderful Christmas song, only got to number two.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune, I turn my face away.
So it seems to be, if you want to have a sort of long-lasting impact on Christmas music, that seems to be the spot to get.
Sophie, are you claiming Christmas number one refugee status now in the U.S.? I mean, you're trying to get away?
It's funny, after I wrote this story and I posted it on Facebook, it's funny how many people I heard from who live in the U.S. now who are sort of like, oh, I miss this tradition. And it is always a fun one every year to kind of just see the horrors that are going to be inflicted upon the British people. But you know, it's a tradition like any kind of tradition. You sort of miss it during the holidays.
Christmas is all around me, and so the feeling grows.
And that was my conversation from last December with Sophie Gilbert. She's culture editor for The Atlantic. In recent years, the crown of Christmas number one has been bestowed upon the winner of Britain's version of The X Factor. Last year's number one followed that tradition, when Ben Haynow won with Something I Need. This year's X Factor winner, 17-year-old Louisa Johnson, could still nab the top spot with her newly released cover of Bob Dylan's Forever Young.
May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay forever young, and may you
But Louisa is not a sure thing this year. Because her song debuted at the charts at number 9, some are claiming that the race is still up for grabs, leaving space for this song. Yep, that's the updated theme from the latest installment of Star Wars by John Williams. Fans of the series have been waging an intense online campaign to ensure that it wins this year's top prize. Meanwhile, Justin Bieber recently set a record on the UK singles charts for being the first artist to ever claim the number one and two spots with his songs Love Yourself and Sorry 4 weeks in a row. So there's a chance that he will still be at the top of the charts when voting closes. Is it too late now to say sorry? 'Cause I'm missing more than just your body. The Christmas number one will be announced on Christmas Day. And we're not letting the Brits have all the fun. We have our own number one to crown today. Word of Mouth's first annual holiday song bracket pitted classic artists against contemporary singers belting out some old holiday favorites. And the winner of our first ever December Madness Holiday Song Showdown is...
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Just like the ones I used to know, where the tree.
What can we say? Maybe the choice reflects the mood of those of us on the East Coast who are experiencing what could go down in the record books as one of the warmest Decembers on record. A little snow goes a long way toward getting people in the Christmas spirit, whether in reality or projected in song.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Our heartfelt thanks to everyone who voted and who shared their favorites with us. When we embarked on the holiday song bracket, we knew it would be impossible to hit everyone's favorites. Some of our own favorites got left out of the contest. So here are some of your picks that we thought worthy of a montage.
I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Only a hippopotamus will do.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Come, they told me, ba-rum-pa-pum-pum. A newborn king to see.
We've compiled a list of some of your favorites with links so you can enjoy the word of mouth crowdsourced holiday playlist in the comfort of your own home or earbuds. We are always grateful for your listening time, and as always, there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org and with the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can find by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And please do us a favor, if you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
Soon will come our way.
Santa very soon will come our way.
Eight little reindeers will sleigh.